Welcome to Writing the Wrong Way, where we talk about writing works, how writers work, and why the best writers risk being strange. I've got with me today Pierre Tchaikovsky, or Tchaikovsky, I suppose. If you, I just verified with him how to pronounce it, and then I'm used to doing it the old Polish way, because I have so many Polish friends who insist on the correct pronunciation.
Yeah,
so that's actually the first time I've screwed up a Polish name. I apologize.
Yeah, it's only because my family's been screwing it up for 100 years, so that's not on you. That's we're bringing shame to the homeland.
And in addition to being a writer, Peter, you also are the creator of the Story Engine, which I've actually got the Story Engine in front of me here for people watching the video. You know, this is the kind of box of it. Then I also have the first, I think it's the first spinoff you've done with this Deck of Worlds. And you've got a new, by the time people are listening to this, you'll be running a backer kit campaign for the new expansion, which is related to lore. And I'm curious, so I love getting into these kinds of game / writing tools / I mean, you've really designed this story engine to work as a tool for writers, or as a game in and of itself, or as a tool for like somebody constructing a role-playing campaign or their own, you know, fictional world. So I'd like to just dive a little bit into what these things are. Again, I've got two of them in front of me, and then I'd like to talk about the third that you're doing, and also just a little bit about sort of how this all came to be. Because early on, correct me if I'm wrong, but you mostly were writing flash fiction and you know, prose fiction in a sort of simpler manner before you moved into this, the complexities of these games. So I'm curious to know a little bit about your path and what led you to sort of developing the story engine in the first place.
Yeah, flash fiction was definitely my wheelhouse when I was working on this. And I come from a background of, I've always wanted to write in different media, but when you're like, you know, one person starting out, you end up having to be your own production team, depending on if you're trying to write stuff for video or do comics. So I spent a lot of time, I guess, looking at the ways that writing can translate from medium to medium. I wrote a lot of like music, sometimes serious, sometimes comedy. I did videos, I did comics for a long time, did flash fiction, did some longer short fiction, but I always found the short formats worked really well for me. And I think something I've been become obsessed with, I think because I'm someone who produces a lot of volume variety of like different types of writing, has been idea generation, right? Like, how do you generate an idea? How do you workshop an idea into something that feels like more of a viable experience for someone, because the format that your writing takes can be so variable, right? Like there's so many different ways to publish now, and I don't just mean like online or in prints, but like, you know, memes are a form of writing, right? People write memes. Someone does create it at some point, and it's because they had a thought that they were able to encapsulate quickly and put it in a visual format. And the difference between a meme and a comic is just really whether or not the person drew it, but they're still adding this visual element to a piece of writing and making it short and effective. And, you know, the line breaks matter, which is an element of poetry. So I am obsessed with how different genres cross-pollinate, where they give each other lessons to learn from. And I'm also obsessed with how people come up with ideas, like just endlessly obsessed with learning about human brain and idea generation. And the Story Engine deck was sort of my first foray into trying to map some of like what does make a story, whether you were writing a screenplay or a flash fiction or a comic. If you kept boiling down what a story is, what do you end up with? And there's a sentence that I've just always loved from the Canadian novelist Douglas Glover, who said in The Enamored Knight that a story consists of someone wanting something and having trouble getting it. And I don't think that like all stories have to be diagrammed this way necessarily. And I do think it's a very like, you know, modern Western way to diagram a story and other time periods of other things that they care about and other cultures of things that they care about in a story. But I do think it's one really useful way to think about it. And that tool became one of the ways that I started looking at how can we break, if we were going to build a story out of Lego, what are the types of pieces that we need to be able to assemble something that always looks like a story? So someone wanting trouble, the thing that they're trying to get, and then for me, I added a fifth category of just sort of descriptive cards. But basically, that became the agent deck as the someone, which is like, who's the story about or who's involved in the story? There's an engine deck of cards, which is what do they want? What is the motivation for them in the story? There's an anchor deck, which is like places, objects, events, which is often, if the person wants something or has some kind of vector that's driving them in the story, what is that connected to? Whether it's a place or a thing or a time. And then a conflicts deck, which is like either the obstacle they have to overcome or sometimes the price that they pay for getting what they want, if it's a pay later situation. And then the aspects deck, which is just these short descriptive words. And what I found was when people would pull a prompt with these five card types, and something I'll mention is like Legos, you can build them into different structures. It doesn't always have to be one of each of the five cards. You can map story, you can use this as a story mapping tool. But when you have at least one of each of those five cards, you really have like not just an idea for a story, but a structure for it, and a structure that tends to lend itself towards like a good, compelling narrative where there's somebody who wants something, there's something for them to overcome, there's stakes, and if they succeed or fail, and there's a few specifics about it that make them feel different and interesting and fleshed out. And the trick is like the cards are very sparse. There's not a ton of text on them. They're very light on text, and I think that where a lot of like creative writing prompts or prompters have failed is they've given closed prompts where like here is the whole prompt. It basically gives you the story and then you just fill in the blanks. This is like you're choosing and building the prompt yourself. And I think what the kind of weird magic of it is there's so little on the cards. It's what happens when you put two cards next to each other and your brain before the editor wakes up and has a chance to be like, that's a bad idea, don't write that, or makes you second guess yourself. Your brain's already kind of building a story out of it. And like, human brains are very much like pattern making and recognizing engines. And I think that what the deck does really well is it just invites the brain to fill in the blanks. Like, how would these two things connect? How would this character and this motivation connect? And what you end up with is really not what's on the cards. What you end up with is this larger context that you filled in yourself creatively, and that's engaged those storytelling and brainstorming parts of your brain in a way that it's almost instinctive. Like, there's definitely like frontal cortex stuff involved here. Like, you do have to do planning and thinking and problem solving, but it gives you a structure to do that around. And the thing that I find is it's almost involuntary. Like, you can put cards in front of someone, and even if they're not engaged, they're going to start finding little connections about, like, why does, say, the card that you drew, where it's like a key or a keepsake, why does that matter so much to somebody who's a gardener? Why would a gardener care about a key? Well, maybe they have, maybe there's a shed, maybe there's a garden shed, and it's the only key, and there's something really important in there. What's in there? Well, I can draw a new card to fill that in. So I think it becomes really good for getting people to the starting line where ideas happen and feel viable, and it gets them past a lot of the blocks that stop you from getting there. And it really makes it something that is their own. Like, we're in an age of a lot of prompted writing and AI writing. And there's a lot of debate around like what is writing if something else is doing it for you. But I think at the very least, like being able to this tool lets you do most of the writing on your own. And I think that's what has been fun about it and what has made it sort of halfway between a game and a tool is that there is that sense of play to it.
You get into a lot of things there. I just want to note from the aside, as an aside, that I have a PhD in Canadian literature. So when you drop Douglas Glover in, that's a real good deep cut for the, the Camlet people among us. But there's so much in what you said that it is really interesting. So one thing just to kind of touch on briefly for people who may not know as much about it as you seem to know, which is that neuroscientifically, that's what your brain is doing all the time, right? It's constructing narration. Your brain, for good and ill, is a narrative machine, and it'll build a story, sometimes a story that serves you well, sometimes a story that does not serve you well, about the world and the events that occur randomly in the world. But it also will entertain you potentially by putting things together. And as you say, like, you just start to get, your brain wants to construct narratives. It'll naturally start doing it. And the more, and once you kind of have a structure, like what I like about this story engine, when I started looking at it myself, because I did kickstart this as well, is that as you say, it's had much more of an open loop. Like, it presents these open loops as opposed to, like, I'm doing it for you. There's no fun in the prompting the AI, and then you get exactly what you want. What I find, just to kind of jump on that tangent for a second, my sort of little contention about AI art in particular is that this is the time when it's interesting. It'll become less and less interesting, because what's going to happen is it'll stop making mistakes. Right now, what's interesting is the mistakes that it makes. And once it does precisely what you tell it to do, is when it'll become effectively useless. Because at that point, there's nothing for the human to do in it, in the sense, and there's nothing good that it can turn out. It just can't add to your creativity. It can only ape it. And once it's aping it, it can't, it's not going to be as good as the accidents. The kind of where your brain wires itself wrong and starts to do things incorrectly, and where it has like these juxtapositions and it makes a weird leap and it short circuits rather than giving the sensible connection, is really where a lot of this creativity comes in. And what I liked also about the open loop nature of this is when I advise people in creative writing classrooms, if they say they're stuck, or they have writer's block, or they don't know what to do next in the story, my sort of joke answer is, if you don't know what to write about, you just open your fridge and write about what's in the fridge. Because there's a level at which people are, they kind of make the idea too important, and the idea almost is irrelevant and doesn't matter. In a sense, like what's great about the Story Engine is, yes, it's an idea generation tool, or it can be used to generate ideas. But as you say, what's more important in many ways is just sort of playing with the idea once it's kind of there, as opposed to just, get an idea, get an idea. So one thing I just want to quickly just to illustrate what you were talking about for people. I'm just going to run through, I just picked, the five cards here as you were talking.
Awesome.
And each of these cards, so for example, you have your agent card that you start with, right? So the way that Peter's designed these is each of these cards has four options on it. So if I could pick one randomly, like, north, south, east, west, or I could just look at them all and choose one. So I'll just do it randomly though. So in this case, I've got an actor, and then, wants to be saved by a keepsake, or let's change it to a house. Or let's say they want to save a house. So I'm turning it upside down, just take the other option. So I'm editing as I go, right? But they must reconcile with an old enemy.
Oh, I've got a story pitch for this already. I really like
See,
this.
and I haven't even added in that it's deceptive. An empty house. Let's change it to empty house.
Okay, so I'm imagining an abandoned theater, like an abandoned playhouse, that's going to be shut down and destroyed, something historic. This one actor just absolutely loves it, wants to save it, but the only person with enough name pull to like make an influence here is like the person who like got the role that ruined their career and that other person's career took off.
Great.
In order to like make it happen, they have to basically do an event with someone that they've always thought was like the hack who took the what was supposed to be rightfully theirs. And especially I like that idea of the empty playhouse, like really emphasizing. Oh, and you could do so much with that because the empty playhouse is like maybe theater is changing. Maybe this other actor who succeeded has leaned into we're in like a digital age. No one goes to the theater anymore. It's all about video. This other person like loves, this increasingly abandoned form of art of like physically being in the theater. So that vision of the empty theater is very much like this is the world they want to save. But
But it's
also
a
like,
fake world, a constructed one. It has all
yeah.
sorts of thematic resonance once you put the one of the things that kind of happens naturally, and you're sort of doing it live there, is because the prompts are minimal and open. Again, I've got a house that but then house combines with actor. You've changed it to a theater, a playhouse, like a theater house. Of course, what's so great about that, and once you make a change, or once you pick any of these items and delve further into it, of course, there's just established ways in which there's already material there. When I'm in teacher writing, I call this, you've got a site, which is something I took from an old professor of mine, Dennis Cooley. He always talked about mining a site. You find a site, then you mine the site. You see what's there. And what's so great about the kind of level at which there's some specificity, but yet there's enough, openness to these prompts and sort of how they might combine, is that, once, as you say, once you're in a theater house, there's like naturally things that would happen there. There's naturally things that wouldn't happen there. Acting just in and of itself suggests deception, potentially, and all the positive and negative connotations of acting. It's just all, the house could be in disrepair, right? Depending how old it is, you've got, so many, the profession suggests, as you say, a political structure. Like once you have some elements, there's always other elements that kind of naturally fill in.
I've got another pitch to add to that structure. So I like the idea that it's in disrepair, and I like the idea that our main character actor loves it so much that like they want to, whatever the like the save the theater event is, they want to host it in the theater, even though they know it is not safe. And the deceptive portion is they know that this will be a risk. They're telling people, no, it's fine. Like we got licensed to open or whatever. And they're willing to like, and this is the thing that we know is going to go wrong in the final act, is like the stage is going to collapse or something's going to happen. And we have this protagonist who like, we understand what they want and why they want it. We probably even identify with that. And like, who doesn't want to save a beautiful old theater? But then the methods by which they feel is necessary to do that is the thing we disagree with. And that's like that tension of who our protagonist is. I get very excited by that idea. And then we know what the stakes are. Like it gives it, we can already see what the shape of this is going to be. And all you need is like a contractor in act one, being like, I don't know if these stands are, if like if you succeed as much as you want to, I don't know if these stands are going to hold or whatever. And they're like, that won't matter. And then we know it's going to matter. It's somebody coughing blood into a napkin and into a handkerchief in act one of anything set in the age of tuberculosis. It's our like, this person is sick and this is going to matter later moment. I love what you said about sites. And I think what's nice about a certain definition of site is that, you can mine some of what's already there, but you can also furnish it. It's not so specific. Yes. You can't bring some things with you to fill it out, especially to make sure that it serves your story as more than just a random element, but an intentional element as well. And it's that balance of like randomness and intention that I think is part of the magic of how the deck works. There's a random element that gets you out of the same like grab bag of images or settings or characters that you're used to using that you're not even aware that you're used to reaching for so easily. It forces you out of that path a little bit, but you still, like you said, there's multiple cues in the card. You choose the one and you choose how you interpret it and redefine it. And it's that balance, I think, between intention and randomization that makes for a good prompt.
Plus you got the free floating modifier here, which I thought was the aspect card, you call it, which you technically don't need, right? Like technically, I mean, yes, you need somebody, and that you need somebody to revolve the story around. You need some sort of engine, you know, some sort of premise. You need a conflict, the anchoring, like grounding it in a particular way, and then adding the color of the aspect is, I think, a really useful set of tools you've got in there. So much of the problem I find in creative writing is figuring out where is the inherent structure. And if you can find like a story that has some inherent structure to it, it helps, you get quite a long way. Like that's why sports movies always have that kind of like, what's nice about a sports movie, they're not my thing so much, but what's nice about them structurally, story-wise, is that there's an inherent structure to a game. And then everybody knows, like the audience knows how many innings you play in baseball, right? And so there's a level at which you can just follow this structure that's set, and you can twist it. There's a place where people expect it to go. You can move it away from that. And in some ways, what you've got with a story engine, I think, is it's sort of giving some inherent structure to maybe a shapeless notion. And then, of course, you could change it up or tweak it as you go. But it gives you like a bit of inherent or initial structure to hang really the better parts of the idea, which are the sort of way that you're going to fill it in yourself.
Yeah.
Because it's not a paint by numbers system. Like some of the other systems that you see are very paint by numbers, which I never really understood the point of. I'm curious to know though, just to kind of step back for a second, what really led you to think, I'm going to make this deck? Like once you kind of hit on the idea of like, wouldn't it be great if this was the case? There's that whole other step of like actually doing it. And I'm curious to know a little bit about that story.
Yeah. So that happened in tandem with writing a lot of microfiction. I was doing, I have a website called shortestory.com where it's on hiatus at the moment, but I was posting 2 postcard sized short stories every week. And that just meant like coming up with a lot of ideas. And sometimes those were less short stories and more like a brief internal monologue, but that has some kind of like joke or twist or moment in it that, makes it feel like a moment you're capturing in someone's mind. It just meant coming up with a lot of ideas and thinking about like, how do I know that this idea counts as a story? What's the anatomy of a story such that this has all the organs and you can call it a story? I think it was a combination of thinking about stories constantly, trying to come up with a lot of stories, and also finding that the microfiction format gave me permission to not worry if a story was good too much in advance. That really helped because when I was writing longer form short fiction, you can spend, sometimes a short story, you are blessed by the muse and it comes out in like in a few hours or in a day, and sometimes it's like you're coming back to this thing for weeks. And when you start to think about the end product viability of it and starting from that perspective and that sense of play is gone, you're doing you start with the not with the ending, but start with thinking of it as a finished product and then try and work backwards from there. So much of the joy of the process is gone. So much of the play is gone. And I found that I wrote so much less. And I think a lot, as I understand it, a lot of the study of creativity has been that you produce better works when you produce more bad works than when you try to produce one great work. A lot of I think a combination of anecdote and some amount of probably not very well controlled study that I've looked at has basically said like if you do volume with some intention and studying your process and looking at your process as you go, but volume will help you get to producing one better thing than just focusing on making that one better masterpiece a lot of the time. And I think mileage will vary and not every brain is the same, but I think that those principles of letting yourself experiment, letting yourself play are important. And what I wanted to do was to give create I started to look at like if I was going to create a tool that would just let me play with the story structure, swap out characters, swap out motivations, and to really look at like how a story is malleable and how a story how you can like engineer and tweak and adjust a story. What would that look like? How would I diagram it? How would I break it into parts? And the first iterations of the deck, like there was no conflict deck. The motivation deck had conflicts baked in. So the idea was that like whatever they wanted, there'd be a problem with it. And the problem was coded with that want. And so there's just a lot of iterating of like, okay, well, what if we broke those into separate things? Can you, if you randomly match a motivation with an obstacle, does it still make sense? And again, I found more and more that like it just letting your brain do the work of filling things in automatically and just setting it up with, it's kind of like constellations, right? Like none of these constellations look exactly like the thing that we say they look like, but our brains look at this big set of points and we pick out a pattern that makes sense to us. And I was realizing that you can actually trust the brain to do a lot of that work and to do it like in ways that are both unpredictable and reliable, that are like creative and divergent and that you couldn't have predicted before you start the process, but that you reliably get something that is like interesting. And I've experimented with this deck with the early prototypes I ran by like some very sciencey people who do a lot more convergent thinking, like how do we engineer and end up at it. Like this is the point we want to get to. We're not trying to explore a bunch of paths. How do we get to this point? And they could still do the thing where they could assemble the cards into a story, whether they were thinking literally or abstractly. Basically the process was I want to write a lot of microfiction. I want to come up with a lot of story ideas. I'm playing with like what happens if I substitute this character or this setting. And then trying to find ways to model that in cards and prompt drawing. It sort of turned from a thought experiment into a prototype into a like I'd already been on Kickstarter enough that I'm like I think other people would like this. And when I launched it, I co-launched it with it was my new book of postcard fiction. I thought that was going to be the headline. And then also, hey, here's this deck that I've been working on that is like about, you come up with your own writing prompts. It's helped me with some of this, and they were developed in tandem. And then very quickly it left like the circus of people who usually follow my writing and exploded into like a lot of people want just the deck and they do not care about the short stories. And on the one hand, there's a moment of ego death where you're like, but I want you to want the stories. And on the other hand, you're people are telling you what they want and that they're willing to support you in making it. And when you get that kind of clear excitement for something, even if it's not the thing that you thought was the headline, you take it and you listen and you run with it. And it very quickly grew into the thing that is like now what I work on full time is creative concepting decks and thinking about ways to help people approach writing more creatively and to find play in writing.
When did you realize this, for lack of a better way to put it, was becoming its own little brand and business, and that you would have to either go down that road or not?
It was during that first Kickstarter. I think I set out with a goal of 20, 25,000, something like that, for book and this little originally the box was going to be like this really tiny box and just as compact as I can fit the cards. In the first 3 days, it became very clear that a lot of people were very, very interested in the deck concept. And could see the like they saw what I was excited about in it too. And very quickly, that $20,000 budget started growing to, like, I remember like 10 days that I think we were at something like 75,000, which made it the biggest Kickstarter I'd done to date. And it kept spilling over. And I think by the time we ended that project, it was a little under 300,000. And that was so far and above the biggest project I'd done. And like, luckily, I had delivered a bunch of projects. So this was a matter of the same tool set that I already had of like knowing how to stick to a project budget, how to map a production timeline, how to work with like print production, all those tools. Basically, I just had to scale them up a little bit. But that was the moment when I realized like, okay, I think that there's more to this than just one Kickstarter. I think there's going to be, people were asking immediately for how to be able to pre-order it. People were starting to talk about ways they wanted to use the deck in uses that I hadn't even thought of. And one of the nice things about this is that you can basically treat almost you can make it like a little model train set where the stations are the agent cards, the characters, and the anchors, the like locations and objects. And the motivations are little lines that connect them. You can use them to map these really complex stories where person A wants something from person B. Person B's motivation is tied to location C. Location C is having a measurable effect on character C. And all of these come with their own conflicts and are tied in. And you can end up using it. Anyway, sorry, I've gotten off the tangent of how I realized it was its own thing. But basically, I think when people started making their own prompts for it and coming up with their own content, and I realized like this is taking on a life of its own. The community is seeing this as a tool that can be used for more things than just let's make one story prompt. That people were starting to suggest like, hey, what if you did a world building deck? I love the idea that I can make all these characters on the fly for my fantasy novel or for my D&D campaign, but I would love to be able to like see what world they inhabit. And when I started getting more and more requests for like people telling me like I would like to see a creative concepting tool that achieves B, C, D. I realized like, I think this is an untapped opportunity, and I love doing it. Like I've always loved the science of creativity. It's always something that I've read about like just in spare time and for fun. And then to actually be able to put those into like tools that people want after being someone who, you know, like being a writer is I think in any country and in Canada, being a writer is its own bruising path. It's different from other places, but it's, you know, it's a I had found what I think counts as success within a writing career, but I was still like you know, you still work to put your work in front of people and have them get excited about it, and you're still you know, it can still feel like a very much an uphill battle. And the first time that I started doing Story Engine stuff full time, it kind of felt like the first time I'd ridden on an e-bike instead of a regular bike. Like you put in effort, and you just get like five times more out in terms of like people being excited to see the thing and to jump on with it. And I realized this is like you know, most people don't write creative prompts. It's not a genre that is like a recognized genre within the creative scope necessarily. Like I think lots of people end up doing work that intercepts with it, but the chance to do that with something that like I didn't even know this was a career. And if I did, I would have like started with this. This is so much fun.
Yeah, well, and also to that point, though, a lot of writers, even if they did hit on something like this, and even if it did take off without them realizing it was going to take off in any way, shape, or form, a lot of them at that point even would not realize, hey, this could be a franchise. This thing could scale. I could have, you know, like I could, you know, structure this in such a way where it's of use. I could build the deck of worlds where, you know, it expands a bit more fully into something that would be useful for a role player, but also somebody who is maybe more interested in developing a fantasy realm for some writing reason. Like it's a very astute approach that you've taken, like with moving it forward in a way that doesn't repeat what you did, because it is a standalone object. Like this deck of worlds is in some ways is an expansion of Story Engine, where you're, you know, you've got a story that's put it in a world, right? Like it's a natural and simple progression in that way, but it also is its own standalone thing that you don't need the Story Engine for it to work, you know, for you and to build. And again, you don't even need to want to be a writer. You could just absolutely be incorporating this into an RPG realm. In there's no reason this couldn't sink into Dungeons and Dragons, for example. So I'm
And I've
curious to
seen.
know, like, a lot of people would have shot themselves in the foot with it, is what I mean to say, because they would have overcomplicated it, right? Or they would have tried to make it too different or made it too much the same? And I'm curious to know, like, how you kind of got your head around doing it the right way. Now, I get it sounds like some of this is because you had a history of doing Kickstarter before this, and you'd kind of seen like, oh, okay, I know what it would cost to ship this. Like, I'm not going to kill myself on shipping. Like, it seems like you had had a few things figured out by this point. But I'm kind of curious to know a little bit more about the background you bring into it by the time you get to Deck of Worlds. Like, why didn't you implode? Because most people, a Kickstarter of that size would actually make them go broke.
Yeah.
Even though it seems counterintuitive, right? And you know what I mean, right?
Oh, 100%. I know what you mean. And that was my recurring nightmare during the success of the campaign. That was like a thing where, I worked with a BackerKit. Originally they were a post pledge campaign manager, so you could have people modify their pledge after the campaign, add on items. And I worked with them on Deck of Worlds for, they also run marketing. They're very good at figuring out how to tell people about the campaign during it. And at the time I was a one person team, although for Deck of Worlds, I brought in a lot of other collaborators as writers. I was still the only person managing the campaign. And BackerKit does really good, just very good like marketing service. And when the campaign started taking off for Deck of Worlds, which reached like over 800,000, there was a point where we need to stop running ads. This is too much success and I'm worried that I'm going to implode. And I don't want any more success than this. Please make it stop. Please make it slow down. And I've had those moments. I think that not overpromising was a big thing. I think a lot of people, they start getting extra budget and they're like, we're going to do a video game and we're going to do an MMORPG and there's going to be a stage play. And I kept it to very much like stretch goals are, we can expand the deck by a little bit. I think we could add some more cards in. We can do some expansions. I hadn't written the expansions yet, but I had them planned out and I made sure that the functionality would work, but I can commit to writing this many expansions. And in a pinch, I could probably, do a few boosters. So we'll try a few of those. But I really tried to keep the stretch goals viable. And then for Deck of Worlds, it took off to a point where I knew I couldn't do it solo. And I'm actually like, this is the week that I fully incorporated the story engine and brought on a business partner, Maroki Tong, in our upcoming campaign for the Loremasters deck. You're going to be seeing a lot of her being involved. Bringing on someone who just has much more of a business background. Like, I've done print production business. Both my parents are accountants, so I went to them frequently with questions. And ultimately, at the end of the day, it was just me and my spreadsheets. But that was the expertise that I had to back me up when I was having them double check my thinking on things. But to have somebody who has much more of a like strategic business background coming in to help me with this, where like I can now be more focused on the creative, and where I can have someone who is good at recognizing when I'm being like overly conservative. I think I'm so anxious about disappointing people that I shy away from risk very, very, very proactively, to the point that I think I limit opportunity. So having someone else who's very, very good at recognizing, is this like bare bones viability going to be good? But who's also willing to be like, hey, I understand that you're worried about this because you haven't done it before, but that's not a reason not to try it. And here's all the reasons that we can guarantee that this will be viable and we can make it work. It's a huge help. And again, that's one of the ways that it's forced me out of doing the same creative patterns and the same business patterns. It's like having someone to be like, what if we tried it a different way? And you didn't have a death grip on this is the only way to do it because it's worked in the past. And that's been, a healthy and wonderful process to go through.
For people listening who maybe are confused, like my question even really means, like, if you actually take a look at this Deck of Worlds, so like physically, again, one, it's a physical object. Two, there's a box. The box opens up and folds. The box has a plastic insert. In the Deck of Worlds, you've got six separate card decks in there, plus there's a printed, insert. So you're dealing with paper. You've got I'm guessing you have four vendors for that, Peter, is that correct?
No, I was able to work through one printer.
That's
for
pretty
it.
Impressive.
One printer who was very good, and who actually, they were the ones who brought the idea for the treasure. I call it the treasure box lid.
There's also a slipcase, but the thing people may not understand is like, once you're in the physical realm and you're printing things and you're shipping them as well, all those prices can change I mean, I don't know, without getting the details, I will guarantee everybody listening that from the time Peter collected money for this to when he shipped it out, the prices went up. And what will happen is, what can happen in Kickstarter campaigns, especially where you're taking pre-orders, You can end up, if you don't have the right margins, or you don't have the right prices, or you just, you know, the prices go up too fast, or there's some delay that causes a price increase. What can happen in these sorts of scenarios, if it's not set up precisely right, is every time you sell one more, you go further in the hole. And this is why people, you hear all these Kickstarter campaigns. I mean, this isn't what happened with your campaign. You did very well with it. It's on, you know, and you fulfilled it more or less on time and so on. I've got it sitting here. But a lot of people, like, this is what destroys them, is that they didn't set it up properly. And they didn't realize this would be a problem, but all of a sudden, you know, $1 million comes into their bank account, but they owe $2 million now. And they didn't realize it would have been fine if they only sold 100, but, you know, it turned out they sold 10,000, you know. And so it's very impressive that you not only managed to put together something really interesting and useful here that isn't too complicated, isn't too simple, it has a use, it's open, it's not so closed, but also like the thing is of good quality, it's put together, it came out at the right time. Like, you know, there's a lot of things that people don't realize that go into logistics of something like this.
Yeah, it was an immense, immense undertaking. And actually, again, I will shout out Maroki Tong, who took on so many of the logistics this time so that I didn't have to. I did the logistics mostly solo for Story Engine, and it was so complicated. Like, we had one of our cargo vessels almost get shipwrecked. Which is never, like, I didn't know shipwrecks were still relevant to modern business, but like, straight up, our container had to do an emergency stop at the port of Tacoma for repairs. I've had campaigns delayed by like the Longshoremen's Union strike in California. You really start to see how the world is in the lore of our own world, there are deep connections that make everything that we experience in the world happen the way that it happens. And, you know, supply chains are, we really saw them put under stress tests over the last few years between COVID and some just general freight crisis happening at the same time. And paper got really expensive around the time that we were producing this. So, mm-hmm. It's definitely a huge undertaking. Yeah.
Before we get into the new one, the lore, let's just put a place together. So I'm going to pull cards from Deck of Worlds. So I've got a lake. The lake has a gate near it. It's a gated lake, let's call it. At the end of the world. I like that one. Gated lake at the end of the world that was once a living entity.
Oh.
And this is also the habitat of a rare insect, but, you know, unemployment is at an all-time high. So you're going to have to go there. We're going to have to see if any are left.
Yeah.
See if we can sell them.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Love it.
It's such a great, like, that Advent card is a real trickster, but that was a really interesting addition. Can you talk a bit about the Advent card? Because again, when I see decks like this, this is a sort of differentiator between like a good and bad one. It's like, can you do something with the landscape that you just put together?
Yeah. So there were two reasons that I put in the Advent deck. The first was I wanted the Deck of Worlds to be able to map things physically. So you could produce like a physical map of like, this is roughly in this direction in relation to that. But I also wanted it to be able to give just a rough sense of time in one area. So if you look at it, the origin deck kind of establishes some point in the past for how this place came to be the way it is now. The attribute deck is very much about establishing a status quo in the moment. So we have origin decks establishing the past, attribute deck gives you a snapshot of the present, and then the advent deck gives you that arc into the future of like something that is about a coming change. So it gives you that a sense of this place is more than just like a brief vignette. Instead, you get this sense of it existing through time. And I really, that was an important element to me. And the advent deck especially is like, that is your story hook. That's what stops it from being a background and makes characters interact with it like it's a real place. So for the Advent deck, it introduces a problem. That's the trouble in the story. And it's very hard to play an Advent card and not think about like how would the characters deal with this in a novel, or how would my players interact with this if, you know, like say the food riots starting in the city are going to affect them or affect the way they shop, or if you know the classic meet in a tavern scene is different because no one's able to afford the food, so everyone's just drinking and everyone's like outrageously drunk and angry, like that's going to totally change the complexion of a starting scene. So it comes with a story hook built in. So yeah, the Advent deck was really important to me for those two reasons. And the other thing that I really like about the Advent deck is because it's trouble, it's a good invitation to think about who the trouble affects. And I think that's always a really interesting question when you're doing setting-based writing, is like, well, okay, so food shortage, who's that gonna hit the most? Who's really gonna feel that? And one of the things that I like using the Advent deck for is brainstorming, like if I am gonna write a story in this world, who would it be about? And you look at the Advent card and you decide like who is most affected because they're going to have the best story to tell in this location.
That's a great insight. I always will try to encourage people on that point in creative writing classes as well. Like they'll often have a story and they have an idea that story is going to happen to this person. And that's usually the person who's most like them. Like they put themselves in the story 100%. In some form. But what we often will have to point out to them is like, no, actually this other person in the world has a bigger problem.
Yeah.
And I always think like that's the simple way that I frame it, is like, who in your story has the biggest problem? Like, you know, if there's a monster, if the dragons are coming out of the sky, like who does that create the biggest problem for? And you know, that person is your main character broadly, unless there's a really good reason they shouldn't be.
Yeah. Go where the material is richest. Fully agree.
Well, can you talk a bit about the lore master and how that fits in or stands on its own and just sort of what it looks like? Again, by the time people are listening to this, they can go look themselves at BackerKit and you know go back this thing and find out more about it there. But like to give people just the sort of nutshell of what it is and how this is sort of the next thing.
Yeah, so Lore Master's deck took what I liked about Story Engine being able to map multiple vectors of relationship and just expanded on that and took it so much further outside the realm of just like you have characters and then you have places and objects and that's it. It kind of marries building stories that are powered by the relationships and connections between people and places and other things. It takes what works about that and what works about setting generation in Deck of Worlds and combines it in a way that I think makes for a really organic process of starting with like one node in a web or a network and expanding out from there organically and starting to see how it's connected to all these other nodes and what motivates them and the ways that they depend on each other or influence each other. So you start by drawing, I actually have the alpha copy in front of me, sort of fresh from the printer here. So there's 8 card types so that we can map just a wider variety of the types of things that you'll generally see interacting in a world. So we still have a characters deck. They're called figures in this deck, but we reuse the color scheme and the icon from the agents deck. The cards are balanced a little differently. The ways that the cards need to interact with other cards requires a different balancing than the way they balance the cues for the main deck. But every single card is double-sided. So whereas we used to have say the attribute cards could apply to any type of card in a deck of worlds, or the aspect cards could apply to any type of card. The descriptors are a little more complex and they come on the back of the card. So you can every card has basically double value. So you'll start by laying out the top side where you pick one of the main cues. So we can have a character who's a craftsperson, a linguist, a wrestler, or an autocrat. You'll rotate and pick one, and then you'll pull 4 of the backside prompts and start to connect these. And the backside prompts are broken into backgrounds, agendas, and traits. So agendas work a little bit like the engines did, but a character doesn't actually have to have one to be connected to the world. They can be connected to the world through something that happened in their past. They can have traits that get a little bit more complex and are much more based in describing people than the aspect deck, because the aspect deck had to be a multi-tool as to describe locations and objects and people too. It ends up being very split between different types of values. What's nice about this is we really got to drive into like mannerisms of speech or mannerisms of appearance or behavioral tics and really get to representing, I think, the sort of that greater complexity of like what makes people unique. So you'll flip 4 of these over, you'll tack one onto each side, and on every card there'll be at least one, usually 2, prompts that have another little icon attached. And this means that once you've drawn this card, you draw another card on that side and tuck it underneath it to say like, well, what does it connect to? So here's an example. An agenda is this character wants to gain entry into a faction. or their background is that they have a lifelong infatuation with another figure. So you'll pull this card, you'll tuck it under, and then you'll pull another card, set it off to the side, and you'll start to build out, like you'll actually see the spider web form. So this sort of, I call this like a nucleus. This nucleus will spin off another nucleus that's connected, and you'll start to build this massive molecule of characters, of factions, of objects, events, material types, creatures and species and locations, that all have different types of relationships to each other, and that all of which have those backsides which give them really specific characteristics that feel correct to the category. And by the end, it happens very organically. It's literally one draw at a time, and you'll feel it start to cascade, where you're like getting so excited that you don't know if you want to explore this side path or finish the current path you're on. But you'll end up with this like a proper web of lore, where you can visually see the connections that tie one nucleus into the next. And you'll have you'll have a main character who betrayed their faction. The faction was formed at a location. The location was later destroyed in an event. The event was precipitated by a different faction. That faction precipitated the event using an artifact. That artifact was crafted from a type of textile that was gathered from a species that lives in a location. Like it becomes this really beautiful way to map things. And I think what I really love about it is, more than any of the other decks, that thing you get where you put two words next to each other and you try to figure out what connects them, that just happens so much more often. And it happens in a wider variety of categories. It's like I was saying about, like, I never thought supply chains would matter so much to me as fulfilling a Kickstarter. Like, you start to think about supply chains. You start to think about, like, what are the buildings made out of in this location if these are the materials that are available or on hand? Or you start to think about, like, if these are the creatures that are part of the ecosystem, how do they interact with human life? And the cues, actually, the species deck was, before there was a lore deck, I was going to do a species deck entirely on its own, just because I love evolutionary biology, and I love creature design. So getting to think about, like, traits of a species, but also traits that tie them to not just humans, but I usually say people, because you may have non-human species or whatever the main characters of the story. But getting to write those cues that really do map those connections and make things feel like they're part of an ecosystem is just so much fun. And spinning prompts out of it has been so much fun and so rewarding. And it does interface with, we piggyback on some of the architecture of Deck of Worlds and Story Engine deck. So you can substitute agent cards from the main deck to fill out the figure deck here. You can substitute location cards, but again, the balance is a little bit different. So you might find you have to draw extra cards to get it to fit, but they work with each other. And I'm working on some what I'm calling bridge expansions, which are basically cards in the Story Engine deck that like an engine will specifically call for a card from the Lore Masters deck. And cards in the Lore Masters deck that specifically call for, instead of there being an agenda on the card, they call for an agenda from the Story Engine deck. So it lets you layer these things. It lets you get a lot more recombinability and remixability out of the ways that they interact. Not needed. You can do it entirely on its own. You don't need the bridge necessarily. You don't need any other deck to make this work. But I do like when people have multiple of the tools already. I like giving them new ways to have them talk to each other and play with each other. So it's been just a lot of fun to build out these spiraling, increasingly complex stories and seeing how the natural connections that start to come out of these.
It's a nice balance that you seem to have hit between like a simple system that has room for complexity. You know, once you bring supply chains into it, it may seem like, I mean, either you're in a situation where you've made it too complicated and now nobody cares, or you've created Dune. Right. Dune is all supply chain breakdown. And like, if you just have like just enough of that interesting, if you have like the core of that story and the engine going, that complexity can come in an interesting way without taking over. Like I find so much, what I like about having the idea of a lore master, like what I like about these sort of three, how they might work together is like, you kind of have, you know, there's a world, we can build a world, we can create, you know, this sort of network of backstory, things that are there in the world and things that have happened in the world, like it's a real place, and, you know, all of a sudden, because it has a history, But then, you know, we can go strip right down to like, okay, but here's the story we're telling. Here's, you know, this person has to go do this thing, and then they've got this problem. Like, you can kind of keep it separated, and therefore it can stay manageable. And the visual side of it, it's just nice to have like that visual representation. I find myself when I write, like, I'm just always buying these colored cue cards, and I'm always like writing things on cue cards and Sharpies, and like half my room when I write has all cue cards and Sharpies.
I
look like a madman because I'm just putting like cue cards on the wall, but like, and pinging, and I'll like destroy cork boards because I'm pinning cue cards to that so often. But you know, it's the only thing I've found that really works, and works when I come back to it after like having had to go do something else for 2 weeks, you know? It's having that visual like anchor, because it just kind of gets you, there's something about externalizing a thing outside of your head in that way, where like, yes, most of it's in your head and most of it's like you're connecting these two things, but there's a shorthand, almost like note-taking way in which the deck is sort of holding the idea for you, in a manner of speaking.
I know some people will leave their prompts out so they have that map for later, or take pictures so they can go back to it, but I really like having the physical there. And the other thing I was gonna say about that, right, and I think that something that really helps is the fact that you can pick up a cluster of cards and move them somewhere else. I feel like with our digital formats, when you write digitally, concepting gets very hard because it's like kind of linear, right? Like you just have enter keys and you add things, and being able to shift things around is helpful. And like, as a poet, I definitely like being able to do digital writing. So I love being able to experiment with line breaks and see the line break and visualize it. But when it comes time for non-linear things, and stories are linear, but they're also in many ways not, right? Because there's multiple levels of connection and motivation. Being able to map things and move the map around without having to destroy the whole structure is amazing. And that's one thing I think that the cards have done well, is like, it lets you relocate. Okay, what happens if I tweak this? What happens if I move this here? You can visualize it, and if you don't like it, you can switch it back. And I think that fear that a lot of writers have, and that contributes to a lot of writer's block, of like, when I commit to this choice, the story stops being alive. It starts being carved in stone. It stops being like a living, organic, malleable thing. I think it lets you preserve that malleability for a longer period of concepting and writing, which reduces writer's block, reduces anxiety, gets around commitment phobia with writing, and also just lets you like experiment and see with like, hey, would, you know, if I did make character A the main character, not character B, would that resonate more? Or if I move this, the main setting into an empty abandoned playhouse, am I going to be able to mine more images and more, more resonance out of that? I really like that, being able to relocate things. And I like being able to map relationships. It's something I've always loved. I love seeing how things connect to things. It's a very hard thing to do with tools. The thing that I'm, these are the prototype, they're too small and I don't think the colors are final, but these are our little pieces for being able to visually map longer connections, so that you don't always have to have things, you don't have to have a card next to another card it's related to. You can draw the connection with them just using little tokens as a little breadcrumb path for yourself later. And I love finding ways to be able to map those connections, and for that to be something that feels fluid and intuitive and not a burden. Because every now and then you're trying to start to map things and you create work for yourself or anxiety for yourself trying to consistently map it the same way all the time. And I like tools that are multi-use and flexible and able to adapt to you as fast as you're thinking, basically.
I find so often with the problem that writers have when they get stuck is that they've gotten hung up on linearity in some form. Like, they've gotten the idea that they need to know what happens next, but they don't. They could just skip ahead. They could see, so often I'll talk to people and they're like, I just don't know what to do next. These guys, they rob the bank and then I don't know what happens. And then later on, they're going to be skydiving though. And I'm like, why don't you just write with them skydiving? Like, nobody needs to read it in the order you wrote it. Not what it is. Or they get stuck in the idea that it's not modular, and you couldn't just swap, like, this person could be a woman instead of a man. Like, you know, why not just swap it around, or just see like, well, what if I take that thing out? What if I add that thing in? What if I rearrange it? I remember being really liberated myself as a writer when they started making programs like Scrivener and other programs where you could finally non-linearly move chunks around of your story and just test different things. I would just test it. Like, what if you ran the plot lines parallel? What if you intersperse back and forth? What if you just cut this whole plot line? Like, what if you switch this from here? Like, you could just suddenly do it really simply. That was what was great about the digital, they started to really create tools that were for writers as opposed to just things that writers would use. Like Word is still probably the worst program for writing a book in. And there's so many great programs now, but there used to be like none. But now the kind of problem has, as you say, has kind of gone the other route. Like now, if it's not physical, what I find is I just forget it's there. Like, and I stopped when I was doing book reviews, I had to tell people to stop sending me eBooks because I would forget they existed. Unless it was like a book on my desk, I wouldn't read it. And what I like about the kind of externalizing things on cards or, you know, with a deck like this is it just, it occupies like real estate in your office or not just, you know, air in your head, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's a way in which it feels like it's something because it's out there and you can turn it around, you can move it around. Like there's just, I don't know, there's just something about the physicality of it all.
Yeah. I'm a big fan of tactile tools. I really like being able to hold it in my hand. And you know, I think there are studies on improvements in attention and memory with physical things versus non-physical things. Like I
and
think
just
you know,
paper versus screens, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's something to be said for the paper and the physicality of that experience that I think just it helps. Again, it's sort of this weird paradox of writing where you kind of have to be in your head, but also you have to get out of your head.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a nice kind of tool for that externalization.
Yeah.
And now, you know, you're kind of thinking about, okay, well, who, as you say, who would this impact the most, as opposed to maybe what was my first idea?
Yeah.
Once this kind of the cards have had the idea or like it's now in them.
Yeah.
I feel like there's a way in which I can kind of divorce myself from the idea enough to be, on some level, I can assess it and make decisions about it that don't feel so emotional, but feel more in tune with maybe how that story wants to unfold.
Yeah, I know for me, like a lot of the writing that I do, less with the creative writing, more with poetry or even nonfiction, is I'm often like collecting the bits of the mosaic that I'm going to build the thing out of. So like, here's a bunch of images that I know are connected and they're all going to be in this poem. And if I put them in the right order, the poem's going to emerge. And I just know that. Same thing for nonfiction. Like the way I used to write a lot of essays was collecting the quotes and arguments, then figuring out the structure from like, okay, so these are the recurring themes. This is what my essay is about. Here's the thesis statement. And then just basically structuring those into an argument that felt linear and concentrated and focused. But it was always for me about information gathering first. Like I'm going to gather all the things. And that's how I even write the decks and prompts is I brain dump as many ideas as I can in a category, write them all out. And then I look back and figure out what's the structure. I've got a bunch of ideas that tie to origins that feels like a deck. And I'll experiment. Like I change deck categories so much during the iterative process. Like I give myself permission to do a bunch of bad prototypes. But I like the idea of like just giving yourself as much raw material to work from. And I do think that's what this is it is raw material and it lets you move it and restructure it and play with it and mold it. In a way that is exterior to you. And like you said, makes it less, like it's not just happening in your head. You have to decide emotionally. You can like actually weigh this card against this card and see how it feels. And yeah, I think being able to externalize a process that has been largely like just kind of an explosion of thoughts that happen internally, it helps a lot. I know I got my diagnosis for ADHD in the middle of Deck of Worlds, like in the editorial process. And I'd been seeing all these people who told me that these decks were really, really helpful for them as writers with ADHD because it helped them focus on one idea at a time, but also like they didn't feel locked in that excitement or that energy they could put into towards restructuring or trying out different things. And it made so much sense in retrospect to like get that diagnosis and find out, oh, that's why so many people with the same neurotype as me have found this really helpful, is it has been a way to help like organize what can be a very chaotic process into something that is a little bit more linear, but still very open, and that doesn't feel like restrictive as a structure. So I have this has helped me organize my own thoughts for a ton of different stories. And now, increasingly, I've finally getting back into playing Dungeons and Dragons for the first time in like 10 years, and getting to finally use it for like campaigns and stuff has actually been a lot of fun.
Oh, that's excellent. And there's an interesting way in which it's both idea generation and note-taking, almost system at the same time. Where can people find out more about Story Engine, or maybe just see what's going on with the current BackerKit campaign?
Yeah, so storyenginedeck.com is sort of the main website for all things Story Engine Deck, and storyengineDeck.com/lore is going to be the redirect to the Lore BackerKit campaign, the Lore Masters deck, and that's going to be running from June 20th for about a month, so you can join us in June and July. And yeah, we'll be doing a lot of demos, a lot of showing off how the deck works and building prompts together. I'm very excited to be like doing a campaign with more of a team this time. It's going to be, I think, a lot more fun, and we're gonna be able to do a lot more like interactive stuff, because it's not just gonna be me replying to Kickstarter DMs until 4 a.m. every morning. We get to actually like do more fun stuff and split the load. So I'm very excited for it. Very excited for it.
Well, that's great. Congratulations. And again, everyone go check out storyengine.com, and storyengine.com/lore is where you can find the new campaign for the new deck. And yeah, thanks again for talking to me, Peter, and keep writing the wrong way.
Thank you.